Chatter on Books. It's Cliff Notes for book clubs. Why read the book if you can listen to Chatter on Books? I'm Jamie McIntyre, your announcer, but you don't care about that. Here again is your host, Tori Clark.
Welcome back, everybody, to Chatter on Books. Lauren Larson's helping us out tonight because it's Claude's anniversary. Happy anniversary, Claude. And it's hilarious because Lauren protects us. Unlike Claude, Lauren protects us and does not start recording until we actually start the show. We'll see. Yeah. I said
ridiculous. She'll learn.
Stuff. Okay. I am very excited about the show, partly because I get to see David, and Mark Stern has come back to join us. And also because this book by David Marinus, Path Lit by Lightning, The Life of Jim Thorpe, is incredible. Absolutely incredible. There's nothing... David Marinus doesn't do anything poorly. He does everything so well, but this one's pretty remarkable. So looking forward to that. But in the meantime, Mark, as you were just saying, fresh off the U.S. Open. Tell us about the tennis world, baby. How was it?
Yes. Well, I don't know how much of it you all watched.
Quite a bit.
It felt like it was like the two different weeks felt like just completely different weeks. The first week was the celebration of Serena, you know, and the sort of the big farewell, which was amazing to see that. And every night it felt like it was like a finals night that she played. And that last match that she played against Iga Tomjanovic it was just vintage Serena. I mean, she didn't have like, she's not what she was when she was younger, but who amongst us is? And you could just see like the champion her come out though and be like, I'm not going away quietly. And it was just really fun to watch. And then the second week was like a welcoming ceremony for all these young players, and particularly this kid, Carlos Alcaraz, who, man, I don't remember ever having that much energy. He played like five setter after five setter. They went to 2:23 in the morning on a Monday night match, which is 3 minutes shy of the all-time record for the latest match ever. So then the next match was against this kid, Jannik Sinner, who's also amazing. They decided they're just going to shatter the record and went to 2:51 a.m. So some late nights, but you're just like, you didn't really get angry because you're like, wait a minute, I'm actually watching some matches that we'll talk about 20 years from now. And then the match against Francis Tiafoe, you know, was just special to watch, and the way he battled back in that was it was just a lot of fun. So it was a great tournament.
It was. I think I said this to you, Mark, via text, and Dave and I have talked about this. I haven't watched that much of the U.S. Open of any tennis for years.
Yeah.
I started watching because the Serena farewell, and I wanted to be a part of that. I have followed her for decades, and she's an incredible woman in so many ways. And I kind of thought, okay, when she's gone, then I'm kind of, but one match after another. And I love these faces on both the women and the men's side. I love these new faces. Francis, obviously, you know, guy from the DMV, which makes us all happy, but he was a delight. It was somebody out there who clearly loves the game, works like a dog, was just, you know, he ran back and forth to his bench. And
I don't want to use the word adorable, but like that, I was like, that's awesome, man. Like, look at this guy. Cause you could see him like looking up and laughing and smiling at the crowd. Like he was in the moment and just having a blast with him. He takes out Nadal. I mean, that was just, I mean, and Nadal is not what he used to be, obviously, but still you're taking out, it's a guy that won two majors this year. That's pretty damn amazing. So no, it felt like a coming out party for Francis as well, really taking that next step, which American tennis needs. I mean, I think it's Andy Roddick in 2003, I think, was the last American to win a major. American male, I should say, to win a major. So it's just, you know, it gives you some hope for the future for men's tennis in the U.S.
It does. And I was really happy to see the other people from the other countries. I love seeing somebody from Spain. I love seeing somebody from Poland. It was really, really nice to see.
All yeah.
What were the killer hours for you? Covering.
Yeah. I think that week when Carlos Alcaraz was keeping me up till 3 a.m. Yeah. Because I'm doing the Kornheiser show in the morning, a couple of those days, you know, I think it ended up being like a 22 hour day or something like that. And, you know, but again,
it was,
you know,
halfway through the second week, Fred and I were sitting here, we're watching who knows which match, and we're having beers and wine and everything else. And I said, you know, every night, like 8:30, we're sitting here having a great time watching this and watching more tennis than we've ever watched in ages. And I said, these people who are covering it, the media covering it, they've been here all day. Yeah. They've been watching every match and they're watching people warm up. It's insane.
But again, it's when you're watching these matches, and it wasn't. Yeah, I know we can all be prisoners of the moment. I mean, like what I just saw is the most amazing thing ever. But I would talk to former players, and there's one person in particular I want to single out because he's become a real friend when I'm on this event and certainly throughout the year. That's Mark Woodford, one of the great doubles players of all times. You know, paired with Todd Woodbridge, the Woody brothers. You know, you're asking him, you're like, okay, and what I'm watching in like Carlos Alcaraz, it's like, he seems like really good. And to a person, Woody included, they all just say, I've never seen anything like this. I've never seen anybody so fast. I've never seen anybody who is just plays the way he does with all the shots in his bag at this young age. He's 19. He's only getting better. So, and Iga Świątek on the women's side, you have from Poland. Boy, who wins her third major? She's 21. And Ange Jabeur, who, by the way, I found out what her nickname is, and I love this. Her nickname is the Minister of Happiness, because everybody on tour loves her, or the fans love her, the media love her. Everybody that encounters her like leaves with a smile. So, and she's come up short, you know, in the final, but she still made the finals at Wimbledon, the finals of the U.S. Open. So you hope that she just kind of continues in that arc. But everything she's doing is historic and amazing.
Chatter on Sports continues with Mark Stern and David Aldridge.
I
really liked her, and then I fell in love with her because at the press conference, they have to do the media afterwards. She popped a beer. She was drinking the Heineken or something like that.
Oh, Jessica Pegula? Yeah. That was a fun moment. Yeah.
It's fabulous. David, do you get fired up about tennis? Do you like this?
Covered the U.S. Open many, many times. Yes. Loved it.
I should say.
No. One of my favorite events, because it's so long and ridiculous, and your 18-hour days every day. I loved it. That's my favorite analogy in when I talk to young reporters. Uh-huh. And I use the U.S. Open analogy, which all of us have had to do if you write, which is it's 1:47 in the morning. Your deadline's in 13 minutes, and it's 5:00 in the fifth set. And if you don't love being there, then you can't do this job. That's the job. You got 13 minutes, big boy. What are you going to say about this match? That's why I love the U.S. Open, because it made you had to do it. You had to come up with something every night for 2.5 weeks. It was fantastic. It was marvelous. I loved it.
Oh, so they should take all the journalism students, the really good journalism students from the good journalism schools, and send them there.
Absolutely.
And just say, okay, sink or swim.
Right. It's great. It's great.
Should we talk about books?
Okay. Yeah, I guess we can talk about books. Tennis is fun, though. Especially now, because all these new young people are so, they don't seem like there's any a-holes amongst the group, you know?
Honestly, and there's like an aged, there's a group just above the really younger players that you're like, well, I've seen some signs out of some of these folks that aren't really great, but the really younger players, you're like, man, this is just going to be a lot of fun. Yeah. So yeah, I would love to go to the Open as a patron with both of you sometime, so I could have a honey deuce, sit in the stands and just sort of enjoy myself with you guys.
That's Open. I have several commemorative cups in the closet behind me. Okay. Let's pretend this is about books. So I'm always pestering people, write reviews, blah, blah, blah. So somebody who's whatever is 007 Pandas put a review on Apple, which I torture myself by going to read these sometimes. But he put a little review up, and he says this, calls it powerfully intelligent, David and Mark. We should be very happy about that. Mm-hmm. This chat on books podcast/book discussion crosses every genre with an in-depth, diverse exploration of novels with a sprinkling of local DC metro area sports. The conversations are intelligent, and I would love more book reports that are wholesomely entertaining for an entire family. That's a challenge. Monday evening, chatter on books brings to mind the days of radio theater as a family sits listening and break out the rocking chairs. As a family sits listening, except now everyone has their head and earphones plugged in. I love that. So thank you, 007 Pandas. Those of you similarly inclined.
One of us is Orson Welles. That's what I want to know. 4:00 in Mercury Theater. And then all the world.
I'm just hearing rocking chairs. Okay. Do you guys
that's brilliant.
The Sunday New York Times book review, the section?
Mm-hmm. Book? Mm-hmm.
So it's just so pretentious from top to bottom. I'm trying really hard not to look at it, but I do. And then I look at the bestseller list just to see who that we've had on the show or we're going to have on the show, et cetera. Distressing number of books by Hannity are off on the bestseller list.
But that's such a scam. You know what that is.
It is a scam. It is a scam.
That's a total scam.
It's one of the reasons I hate this. And by the way, Ron Charles from the Washington Post called the New York Times last week on kind of gaming the system.
Yeah.
Under combined print and ebook bestsellers, I'm going to see if either of you have ever read any of these books. It Ends With Us by Colleen Hoover, number one. Number two, Verity by Colleen Hoover. Number six, Ugly Love by Colleen Hoover, and number 7, November 9 by Colleen Hoover. Ever?
I would love to be Colleen Hoover's agent, but no.
Yeah. Run, no, yeah.
That I have.
Okay.
I've read A Chicken in Every Pot by Herbert Hoover, but that was a long time ago.
So Mary Cadman, USA Today, wrote something about her recently. She is crushing the bestseller list and legitimately crushing the bestseller list. This year alone, according to Mary Cadman, USA Today, Colleen Hoover has managed to write half of the top 10 books in sales. In only 10 years, she's gone from self-published newbie to best-selling powerhouse. And there are more. You keep going down the list. There are more and more of them. The most amazing thing is these books are all young adult, new adult genre.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so the good sign about this, and NPR did a story on this a couple of weeks ago, was Gen Z, which is, what is that, Mark? You're closer than we are, 20 to 25 or something like that.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. Younger than me. They're the ones driving these book sales.
They're reading.
So the good news is they're reading.
That's great. That is good news.
Yeah. Yeah. The bad news is, and it's bad news for this show because I can barely, you know, get anything out on Twitter, is TikTok is driving a lot of sales for young people.
Sure.
Yeah.
TikTok rules the world, doesn't it?
I think especially for young people, which means you two are going to have to start dressing up as penguins or something like that and doing a little dance.
I accept the fact that my younger son gets all of his news from TikTok and YouTube. I have that to accept that.
Okay.
Yeah, it's just a different paradigm, you know, than it was when we were younger.
I used to say, I'm getting slightly better at this, but if I hear something that I'm interested in, you know, pandas, I'll go to my Google machine, I'll type in the word pandas, and up will come articles about pandas, which I will then read, and sometimes they connect. My kids, 20-somethings, YouTube, and increasingly TikTok, if they hear about something, that's where they go. That's their search engine. That's where they get their information.
Right. Exactly. That's where they get the news. So, okay.
Yeah.
Works. We won't be reaching them. Just.
No.
Okay. Did you guys watch any of the Queen's funeral today?
A little bit.
Yeah. A little bit.
Okay. David first, what'd you think?
I mean, it was fine. I had to turn to the BBC. And I don't say that because I'm pretentious. American television tends to talk way too much about everything it's like they can't stand the notion of there being 4 seconds of quiet and contemplation. Yeah. And it's like, guys, this is, look, what I don't have a dog in this hunt. I'm not an Anglophile. I don't care about the monarchy. I'm not I don't study it. I don't hate them. I just am indifferent to it. But I get that. This is a very big deal to a lot of people in England. And you should be respectful of that and just shut up and let the camera. That's why you are on television and you're not on radio. You're not, you know, you're not Edward R. Murrow at the, you know, the 1941. You don't have to describe everything. You know, there's pictures. Let the pictures tell you what's going on. So I watched the BBC.
I'm with you. I switched. I was kind of surfing around. I was up bright and early this morning with a little tea to watch. And I switched as well. But here's why I switched. Because the Today Show, God bless them. Mm-hmm. They have Lester Holt and Savannah Guthrie and Hoda Kotb. And then they would, you know, they had some British historian come, you know, experts with cute like Wilford, whatever. And to give the really important, you know, what is that? What's on the coffin? These kinds of things. And these poor British historians would be trying to give something very thoughtful, to your point, very respectful. And I swear to God, Hoda would interrupt and go, do you think William and Harry are going to make up? Are they going to get back together? Come on. What do you think of what you watched? What do you think?
Listen, it's as somebody who's pretended to be British professionally for almost 2 decades now, I have a very strong bond with the people from England. Mm-hmm. And you'd be amazed at how many texts I got when the Queen died and said, I'm so sorry for you. Even people not actually British. I'm like, okay, that works. But yeah, listen, it's very sad. You know, it's a very sad and solemn moment. And, you know, like both you guys just said, I would rather just see the images and an occasional solemn word said, as opposed to, you know, some frantic play by play of what's going on, you know. But yeah, listen, the British may not do a lot of stuff right these days, but they get pomp and circumstance down to a T. And this is one of those events. that merited that. And the Queen, I think when somebody told me or I heard it that the Queen was alive for 2/3 of like the history of this country, you're like, wow, that's a long run. And, you know, I'm glad that this was done the way it was. And it was, from what I saw, and I did not watch it cover to cover, it was very lovely. And, you know, as a faux Brit, a tear came to my eye, and not a Meghan Markle tear. So I guess there was talk that she, you know, the picture of her tearing up. And I just wanted to say to everybody, she's an actress. Okay. I don't believe that was sincere. That's just me. Don't believe it was sincere. My tears were very sincere.
There you go.
One of the things I did notice, and I watched more of it than I should, because I love, first of all, I respect the hell out of her just for doing her job as well as she did, as long as she did it. Hi, David. We're going to get to David Marins in just a second. Her dedication to service just phenomenal for as long as she did, with so much class and grace and dignity throughout all of it, and all those crazy relatives. But watching that today, it was endless numbers of sailors and footmen and guys in big fuzzy hats and guys in Scottish garb and mostly guys. And
there were hands
and there was this one, that one. And a bunch of them were carrying guns. The ones who weren't carrying guns had swords. And the ones who didn't have swords had little batons. And the ones who didn't have batons had really tall feathers on their hat. And I thought, Freud would have a lot to say about this. One of them had something. I was like, wow, that is something. But it was lovely. Projection. Okay. Speaking of lovely, what a segue. Writers and historians of all time. Welcome to Chatter, David. Good to see you again.
Thanks. Good to see all of you.
Nice to join us.
I'm sorry?
I said you're nice to join us.
Oh, well, of course. How could I refuse? Plus, I haven't watched a minute of the Queen's funeral. So, as Queens go, I liked her, but I have no interest in Queens.
Okay, but as an historian, sociologist, anthropologist, all labels I'm putting on you, what's the significance of her passing?
Well, I hope it means the end of the royalty, because I don't think I want to deal with the King Charles III. honestly, and I think it's about time, and maybe that settles it. But I mean, she was spectacular at her job. I didn't think I could possibly like royalty, but I liked her in every possible way. Yeah. And as Mark said, I mean, she's been around for 70 years, which is kind of awesome and sort of a point of stability in this incredibly chaotic world.
Yeah. Well, I guess it was September 8th when she died. I had a Zoom call scheduled with someone, happened to be a Brit. And literally, as he and I start the Zoom call, he's got TVs on in his office. I've got a TV on in my room here. And they're announcing that she had died. And I said, do you want to do this at another time? Goes, no. Anyways, I said, well, how does it make you feel? And he's just a legit straight up guy. And he goes, it's hard to separate how long she's been around from what she's done. And he says, I'm not into the monarchy either. He goes, but it's like the wallpaper. It's like the house.
Yeah. Always
there. My life.
Always there.
Yep. She's always been there. And so there's this sense of loss, I think, in a very personal way.
Yeah, you folks probably weren't born, but I actually remember her with Dwight Eisenhower at the opening of the St. Lawrence Seaway sometime in the 1950s.
Wow.
It was that far back.
Okay. Should we talk about your fabulous book, Hit Flip by Lightning?
Absolutely.
It's really fabulous. I can't come up with enough superlatives about this. But let's, you know, like I've heard several of your interviews, David, and everyone tells you they read about Jim Thorpe when they were in fourth grade.
Oh, yes.
Right?
I'm sure that David did as well.
Yes. Read those books until I was in eighth grade. Tell us about the title.
Hat Lit by Lightning. Thorpe was born in 1887 in the Indian Territory of what is now Oklahoma along the North Canadian River. And there was a thunderstorm the night that he was born. He was actually a twin, by the way. He had a twin brother, Charlie, who sadly died in a boarding school at age 9 when a disease swept through it, which happened so often. But anyway, the night they were born, there was a thunderstorm. And Thorpe was given the name Wathohawk, which is a Sac and Fox. He was from the Sac and Fox Nation. And the most poetic translation is Path Lit by Lightning. The more common translation is Bright Path, which is fine, but it doesn't illuminate anything. So when I saw Path Lit by Lightning as a translation, I said, that's the title of my book.
You knew right away. So yeah. I say, David, that you can only write about something or someone if you're obsessed with that topic. What was it about Jim Thorpe that obsessed you?
Well, two things. I consider it kind of the third book in my trilogy of sports biographies, Lombardi, Clemente, Thorpe. And in each case, I was looking for two things. One is just that it's a hell of a story, that there's the drama and action of sports at the highest level. But secondly, and more important, actually, is that I can use that to illuminate American history and sociology. And so for Lombardi, it was not just this phenomenal Packer football coach, but a way to study leadership and, even more important, competition and success in American life, what it takes and what it costs. With Clemente, it was not just a beautiful ball player, but also a way to study the role of Latinos in baseball in mainland America, and the rare athlete who was actually heroic. You know, he died delivering humanitarian aid to Nicaragua after earthquake. Most athletes are called heroes and they're not. So Thorpe, unparalleled athletic achievements. I mean, you can't compare athletes from different generations. It's foolish because of so many differences, but no one has done what he did, you know, winning gold medals in the decathlon, pentathlon, being an All-American football player, the first great professional football player, the first president of what would become the National Football League, and a Major League Baseball player. No one has done all of that, but that's not why I wrote it. I wanted to use all of that as a way to illuminate the Native American experience and all the obstacles that he and his race faced from the period of his life.
So early in the book, you talk about the famous Catlin portraits. Anybody, I've seen them a lot, I've seen them in the West Wing of the White House, of, and I'll say Native Americans, Indians, but in some time, Indians was the phrase that was used. But you talk about how society both exaggerated and diminished them, the Indians, the Native Americans. How much, before you started researching this book, and just as ever, David Marinus, outrageous, extensive research, before you started researching and writing this book, how much did you know about the Native American experience in this country? I mean, clearly enough that you wanted to write about it, but how much did you know, kid from
Well, you know, I mean, I try to start every book as though I know nothing. That's sort of my policy. Don't have any presuppositions. So, you know, I'm a baby boomer. I knew about the American Indian movement. I'd studied sort of the modern Native American history. I didn't know as much about the older history. And so everything was fascinating to me. Going back to his birth in 1887, the very year of a seminal act in Congress, the Dawes Act, which was another effort to take away Native lands. This time legally by diminishing their communal property, eliminating it, and trying to make them into private landholders like white people were. And you see that thread all the way through his life of the attempt of basically forced assimilation. I'll say one other thing about that was what I really didn't quite appreciate were the differences between how white society treated Native Americans and African Americans. You know, both diminished horribly, both suffered genocide, both segregated against in terrible ways. But Native Americans were romanticized and diminished. Right. African Americans were just diminished. You know, that's a huge difference. I mean, Jim Thorpe could play Major League Baseball at a time when no black players could. He could go to the South and give speeches at a touchdown club at a time when the only blacks there were the waiters. So there are all these sort of interesting differences between the two races that I didn't fully appreciate until I studied Jim Thorpe.
Yeah, it's one of the most interesting parts of the book. So, David, last week we had on the show Ann Leary, who, wonderful writer. She wrote a wonderful book called The Foundling, historical fiction, but based on the very real story of eugenics in the United States in the early 1900s. And David and Jamie McIntyre were on the show, and we all said, hands up, nobody ever taught us about that. I mean, when I think eugenics, I thought of Nazis. And when I was reading your book and you're talking about the Indian schools, and I want you to talk about that, I thought, here's another chapter most people in this country are not aware of. And it's a horrible expression, but one of the driving theories was kill the Indian, save the man. And so, again, and David, I listened to so many interviews you've done and read them about this book, and they all focus on the sports side, which we'll get to. But I'm really fascinated in your exploration of what happened on the Native American Indian side.
Yeah, it's interesting because in most of my book events, I talk more about that than the sports. But of course, I have to go on sports radio to talk about the book, and that's a whole different matter.
I'm sorry.
David, I once went on a sports radio show in San Francisco, two guys, both former jocks, and one said, man, this is Lombardi. He said, man, this is the best book I've ever read. And the other guy said, well, it's the only book you've ever read. So anyway, I'm sorry.
I've listened to these interviews, David Marinus, and they all devolve to, they are such classic, it's always guys, and they always devolve to, okay, if you were doing Mount Rushmore, would you put Jim Thorpe? And if Jim Thorpe were playing baseball today, who would, you know, kind of stuff. So,
well, Mount Rushmore was stolen from the Native American tribes out there. So that one. Remind me of the question again, Tony. eugenics and kill the Indians, save the man. So, you know, actually it's become an interesting, relevant issue in the last year. You know, the Pope went to Canada and basically apologized for the Catholic Indian boarding schools treatment of the young students. The new Secretary of the Interior, Deb Haaland, has made it an issue. She's a Pueblo Indian from Arizona. But it was the flagship school was the Carlisle Indian School in Carlisle, Pennsylvania. That's where Jim went and gained his fame. It was founded in 1879 by a former military officer who thought that the only way to save Indians was to forcibly assimilate and acculturate them. That meant rid them of their language, their culture, their religion, shear their braids and dress them in the uniforms of the U.S. Cavalry, everything forcibly trying to make them white. And that was the policy of the United States government for most of the last half of the 19th century and the first part of the 20th century. So the first Indians who went there were Lakota Sioux. It was only 3 years after the Battle of the Little Bighorn. And they thought they were going east to show their elders their bravery and to die. Stunning to think about. And sadly, many of them did die at Carlisle and the other boarding schools as diseases swept through those places. So the most haunting experience for me in my research was going to Carlisle. The student cemetery is still there, all of these, a century and more later. And you see row after row of young Indian students who went to Carlisle and never came back.
But like so many things in Jim Thorpe's life, it's on the one hand, awful, on the other. So on the one hand, awful experience at the school. He ran away from at least, I don't know if he ran or ran away from Carlisle, but he ran away from one of the previous schools. But on the other hand, it did help shape him. And then he encounters, and his life is filled with encountering these people, with people famous in history, and having weird relationships. So talk about Pop Warner in the Carlisle school.
Well, Pop Warner was a brilliant coach and a not brilliant human being. He was innovative. He was an early proponent of the forward pass. He didn't invent it, but he was one of the first coaches to really use it a lot in his games. He developed a lot of formations, the single wing, the double wing. What I love about the period, when the early period of the Carlisle football team, they could do crazy things that you can't do today. One year, Warner put a kangaroo pocket in one of the players' uniforms, and they hid the ball in there, the really in the ball trick. Another time, he lined up an end right at the opposition sideline. The guy ran around the opposition bench, came out on the other side, and caught a pass. You could do that then. I wish we could do that today. Anyway, Warner did all of those wonderful things, but he was disreputable in many ways. I mean, it would later come out that he played his players, which a lot of coaches were doing then, as they've always done. One of the central themes of all of my sports books is the fallacy of the innocent past. It was never innocent, and a lot of it was even worse than it is today. Yeah. But anyway, he not only paid his players, he physically and mentally abused some of them. And crucially for this biography, at the moment of Thorpe's real crisis, when the gold medals were taken from him, Pop Warner feigned innocence and ignorance to save his own reputation. But in fact, he knew precisely what Jim had been doing.
Man. David Aldridge, what's your perspective on Pop Warner?
I'm not much into hagiography, so at any point in history. So whether it's Pop Warner or Grantland Rice or all these you know, kind of fabled people from the early part of the 20th century, yeah. sports heroes or not. I always kind of wonder, well, what did they do when nobody was paying attention? You know,
right? Sure. So,
you know, what did they do when it was important to David's point? There was one time when it was important for Pop Warner. He could have stood up and said, you know, I knew Jim was, I knew the guy that paid Jim to play baseball, right? He's yeah. a friend of mine. I was helping him out. It's not Jim's fault. It's my fault. Blame me. Right. Could have done that. Didn't do it. So that's, you know, so it doesn't, I never hold people like that in the esteem that other people hold them. I always, this gets me in trouble today with people in college basketball when they talk about John Wooden. And I look, I love John Wooden. He was a great coach and seemed like a great guy. Tell me about Sam Gilbert. Tell me about that part. Exactly. How'd that work?
So there's a mythology to all of these characters.
Yeah. Okay, David Maris, because we do want to focus a little bit on Jim Thorpe's athletic accomplishments. And you could pick a lot of things, but just 1912, remind people what he did in the year 1912.
You know, you could argue, and again, as I said, you can't compare generations in a lot of ways, but you could argue that Jim Thorpe in 1912 had the best single year of any athlete in history. Not only did he compete in Stockholm and win these two incredible gold medals in the pentathlon and decathlon, which are 15 total events in less than 2 weeks, and he crushed the opposition in both of those. It wasn't close at all. Then he comes home to Carlisle and has a fabulous year in football, an All-American football player who dominated every game, including my favorite game in history, which our colleague Sally Jenkins wrote about, which is the Army Carlisle Indian game of 1912, November 9th. Indians against the Army. The Indians on a level playing field crush Army. Army, one of Army's players is Dwight David Eisenhower, who had teamed with a teammate to conspire to try to knock Jim Thorpe out of the game because he was so great. They did knock him down. He was out for a minute. He got up, kept playing, and pretty soon he knocked Eisenhower out of the game, and Eisenhower never played again. Anyway, I love that game. And, you know, as you mentioned earlier, Tori, Thorpe's life went through so many incredible people. On that Olympic team was George S. Patton. On the bench of that Army game was Omar Bradley. So Thorpe dealt with all the three most famous generals of World War II in that one single year.
And Avery Brundage, who was one of the biggest rhymes with trick of all time.
You know, that I sort of know it, but it still stuns me. I think of Brundage as a fat cat, plutocrat, cigar smoking, hotel hopping, you know, European style, Oriental collector. I never thought of him as an athlete, but he was a decathlete in 1912 and a very mediocre one.
Didn't he quit?
Which I love because you know he has this sort of phony notion of the you know the beauty of the Olympics is not the national competition. Or how well you do, but that you compete. Well, he competed and was doing so badly, he quit after 8 events. You know, just sort of classic hypocrisy.
I wish Sally Jenkins and Avery Brundage were in the same time frame because she would have just disemboweled him.
Oh, she would have lacerated him. Red Smith did a pretty good job, but nobody does it quite like Sally.
I must tell you, one of my all-time favorite quotes is about Avery Brundage, and it's by my journalistic hero, the late great Howard Cosell, who said of Brundage, and this was 1972, of course, after the tragedy, and he said the games must go on. Right. And Cosell, as only Cosell could do, said there was a time for Avery Brundage, the time of William of Orange. Greatest line ever.
That's good.
Boy, that is so true. And of course, you know, 1972 was the last of his outrageous actions. 1936 tops them all, you know, when he basically conspired with the Nazi propagandists to claim that everything was fine in Germany and there was nothing bad going against the Jews there. And then, of course, 1912, throughout Jim Thorpe's career, Brundage consistently refused to do him justice.
Yeah. Okay, talk about Jim Thorpe's life after, you know, when sports, when his athletic endeavors start to win, just because of age. Have you ever read Laura Hillenbrand's story, Unbroken, about Louis Zamperini?
Yeah.
I'm reading this, Dave Marinus, and I'm thinking, this makes me feel the way I did when I was reading that book. Mm. A cool guy, troubled with alcohol, troubled in marriages, yeah. And bad things keep happening. And you just keep going, how does this person keep going? And I felt that way about Jim Thorpe. But
So did I. I mean, when I was researching and writing the final 12 chapters of the book, I kept saying something good's got to happen. And it really doesn't.
There's a pony in here somewhere, but there wasn't.
Yeah. I mean, he lived in 20 states. He had all kinds of menial jobs, including at one point digging ditches in Los Angeles. Yeah. He struggled with alcohol. He had three wives, seven children. The children eventually were very successful and came to admire their dad. But when they were young, they didn't see him much. At one point, his daughter Grace is at Haskell Institute in Kansas, and Jim comes there to perform at halftime. She's 8 years old. He had to introduce himself to his own daughter. So it was that, you know, he was just on the road struggling to survive for almost all of that sort of afterlife, which is what, you know, every athlete, or almost every athlete, suffers from that at some point because their greatest years are in their 20s and early 30s.
Yeah.
You know, if they live, what do you do for the rest of your life? Well, you know, some of them struggle with alcohol and money, and Jim struggled with both of those. Before I started the book, I worried about how much I could get inside him and his head and whether I would like him. I decided he was a good guy. He had faults, but he was generous, almost to a fault. He had no ego whatsoever. He would rather be alone hunting and fishing than being in a parade celebrated. But he did struggle, and that was very difficult. But I came to sort of this sense that you could call it a tragedy because there are many tragic elements to it. But then I started thinking about, well, why did I write this book? It was to illuminate the Native American experience. And at one point in 1915, when Jim was still at the height of his fame, the most popular statue in America was called The End of the Trail.
Famous.
It portrayed an Indian slumped on horseback, the notion that it was all over. You know, it was a dying race, soon be dead, rendered irrelevant by progress, quote unquote. And there were fewer than 300,000 Native Americans still left in America. It didn't happen. They figured out ways to survive, just as every minority group has, luckily, in this country. And they, you know, I can't say that they're all flourishing, but there are now several million Native Americans. They're starting to regain their sensibility, their identity, their languages, their culture, and so on. And Jim Thorpe, in a similar way, faced all these obstacles, many that society threw at him, some of his own doing, but he did persist. He kept going. And I sort of look at that perseverance as emblematic of the Native race.
Yeah, and he, even in Hollywood, and did I read this right? He was in 70 different movies?
He was. He was directed by John Ford and Frank Capra and acted with every famous actor and actress of that era. But he was an extra, although sometimes the publicist would say with Jim Thorpe or starring Jim Thorpe, you'd have a hard time even finding him in the movie, but they used his name. But that was a pretty significant period for him because I would say it was the time when he most asserted his leadership for Native Americans. He became their spokesperson in Hollywood saying, you know, you're having all these Westerns, and you're hiring white guys and dressing them in grease paint or war paint to play Indians and hire us, you know, and stop all of these negative stereotypes in the movies. So that was really one of the stronger parts of his life in terms of asserting his identity.
Yeah, I just get the sense of just this quiet, determined perseverance through all that.
I think he had that. He wasn't quiet when he was drunk. But, you know, I mean, I don't consider alcoholism determining whether someone's a good or bad person. It's an illness. Yeah. And he can struggle with that.
Yeah. Okay, I know we're not allowed to compare athletes of different generations.
Go ahead.
But I will anyways. David, no, I'm going to get David Aldridge to do it. So, Dave, one of the things I learned reading this book was he was not only a good football player, he was good at several different positions.
Sure.
So let's just stick to football for a second. Have there been other players in football? Mark, you can jump in here. Tennis players who can do different things? I don't think so. But football players that were really good at playing different positions?
Then you can't say Carson Wentz, okay?
No.
Oh, sure. I mean, there were lots of guys that were two-way players. I mean, two-way players in the NFL were very common for decades. I mean, it was only into the 60s. It was only when you started to get into this era of specialization that you have now. But guys used to play offensive line, defensive line, linebacker, tight end. There's dozens, hundreds of players that played offense and defense in football. And some very good. Some were very good at it. I'm trying to remember if Frank Gifford played defensive back, but I have in my head that he did. He
was obviously a great athlete. Yeah.
So lots of people did. Sammy Ball was a great safety,
right,
as well as a quarterback, as well as a punter. A
kicker. So, yeah.
Yeah.
But that's close, because Thorpe was not just a great defensive back and left halfback, but also a brilliant punter. Mm-hmm. Who could play in the NFL today as a punter. He consistently punted 70, 80 yards. Yeah. And he was a place kicker. So, you know, all of that combined is quite unusual.
Yeah. And just the cross-pollination of different sports, insane. Okay, so I'm going to
make – he was even good at ballroom dancing, Tori.
Yes, and skating. Yeah.
And skating. A professional hockey team, so who knows whether they really wanted him, but they tried to recruit him to play hockey.
It's insane. Absolutely insane. Okay, nobody cross-pollinated like that, David Aldridge. Nobody.
Well, actually,
my answer to that usually is Bo Jackson could.
I was going to say Bo Jackson
probably could have been a great decathlete if he put his mind to that as well.
Yeah.
So I always consider him the closest to Thorpe's all around brilliance.
Yeah. Okay, David Maris, let's get you out a quasi serious question here with this. You've researched and lived with and covered and written so beautifully about so many incredible people. At the end of this process, which was a few years troubled by the pandemic, how did you feel about Jim Thorpe? Is this someone you wish you had known? Is this someone you would consider a friend? How did you feel about him as a person from beginning to end?
Well, I was worried that I would be disillusioned, and I wasn't. So that's the key thing. But the main thing that happened in this process was, and especially after the book's come out, is that the Native American community has embraced this book deeply, which is what I want to give voice to issues that are important. And so that's really even more important than how I feel about Jim. And I did like him for all of his struggles. I feel most deeply about the larger message of the book, which is broader than him.
Yeah. I think it's as important. It's wonderful to read about Jim Thorpe and read your writing, but it's as somebody who worked for John McCain for years, who cared deeply about Native Americans, right, spent a long time on it. I think it is really important for people to read this and know this. It was David Aldridge. It was like last week, what people didn't know about what went on with eugenics. It's
history. History.
Yeah, it's kind of important.
Now some people want us to know nothing about
Right. Oh, so great. Okay, what can we not wait for next? What's next? That's the last question.
A gap year. 30 years of nonstop writing books. I promised my wife that next year we're just going to chill, see our grandkids, go to Spain, the West. But I'm waiting for Obama to finish his second volume so I can finish my second volume of Obama. So that's likely next.
Good for you. Good for your wife. Have fun. Thank you so much for doing this. The book is Pathlit by Lightning, The Life of Jim Thorpe. It's fabulous. Yeah, everyone should read this. So David Maris, thank you. Lauren Larson, thank you for helping us out. Mark Stern,
great to see you, everybody.
And David Aldridge, thank you all. And we're back next week with two of our favorites, Donnie Walton and Disha Filia, who are amazing, amazing people.
Yes, Son, Chatter On Books are entitled to be entered into a raffle to win a home version of Chatter On Books, which includes a deck of laminated playing cards, a colorful game board, and an hourglass-style timer. Only one entry per person. In case of duplicate prizes, ties will be awarded. Must be present to win.